to the Smokies Podcast. This podcast is about America's most visited national park, the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and the surrounding towns. This area is filled with ancient natural beauty, deep storied history, and rich mountain cultures that we explore with weekly episodes. I am Joseph Franklin McElroy, man of the world, but also with deep roots in these mountains. My family has lived in the Great Smokies for over 200 years. My business is in travel, but my heart is in culture. Today, we're going to talk about Tar Heel Lightning, talking past NASCAR and other mountain cultural touchstones with Dan Pierce. But first, our sponsors. Imagine a place evocative of motor courts of the past, yet modern and vibrant with a chic Appalachian feel. A place for adventure and for relaxation. Imagine a place where you could fish in a mountain heritage trout stream, grill the catch on a fire, and eat accompanied by fine wine or craft beers. Imagine a place with old-time music and world cultural sounds. There is no other place like the Meadowlark Motel in Maggie Valley. Your Smoky Mountain adventures start with where you stay. The Smoky Mountains and surrounding areas is a vacation destination for all seasons. Some of the nation's best hiking trails, waterfalls, outdoor adventures, and family entertainment can be found right here. Start your adventure by using smokiesadventure.com. That's Smokies, plural, adventure, singular.com to explore all the wonderful features of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Trails, waterfalls, Cades Cove, the Elk, and more. Then check out all the awesome family attractions, swanky and interesting lodging facilities and entertainment you and your entire family can enjoy. The goal of SmokiesAdventure.com is to be your leading information source for adventures and experiences in the Great Smoky Mountains. Some upcoming events I want to tell you about. On June 18th at 4 p.m. is part four of the Heritage Book Series with Bob Plott. It's another informative and entertaining and fun afternoon of history, food, and music as a part of part four of our Heritage Book Series. And it's award-winning author and Meadowlark Smoky Mountain Heritage Center General Manager Bob Plott discussing his fourth book, Colorful Characters of the Great Smoky Mountains. And in these books, he weaves the lively stories of vibrant and intriguing characters such as the Cherokee chiefs, Yonaguska Okanasta, I should have gotten this before I got on the Okonostoda. Sorry if I really butchered that name. Dragging Canoe and their allies such as John Watts, along with their combatants, Robert Rogers, Quentin Kennedy, King Haler, the Stockbridge Mohicans, Francis Marion, and others. And then there's modern day icons such as Von Plott, Charles Miller, and Earl Lanning. There'll be a book signing and a barbecue dinner, as well as an evening of acoustic music by Mike Ogletree and friends. The event is free to motel guests and Heritage Club members, but there's an admission charge, $10 for all of the people. Call 828-926-1717 to reserve your place. On July 9th, a mountain icon, Isla Hatter is going to have a program called Wildcrafting and Mother's Nature Natural Garden. And it starts on July 9th at 10 a.m. It's a program featuring a legendary wildcrafting expert, Isla Hatter, and she's also a renowned author, filmmaker, instructor, and tour guide for the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, elite GSM field school education program. She is an expert on edible plants, medicinal herbs, and anything pertaining to wildcraft foraging and Appalachian plant trees and flowers. She is going to give a presentation on all sorts of stuff related to wildcrafting. And then she's actually going to take the guests and people there on an adventure on the grounds and the surrounding area to actually forage things and learn how to do it right in your own backyard. So call 828-926-1717 to reserve your place. It's free for guests and Heritage Club members, and there's a $20 price for admission for everybody else. And then on August 6th, there's going to be the launch of a Cherokee Heritage Series with Davey Arch. And Davy Arts is a world-famous Cherokee tribal historian and award-winning craftsman of traditional Cherokee crafts, specifically masks and baskets, and a beloved spokesman for the Eastern Cherokee tribe. The event will be followed by a barbecue dinner and music, and it's $20 per guest, and it's free for motel guests. Call 828-926-1717 to reserve your seat now and for all events at the Meadowlark Motel. So today we're going to be talking with Dan Pierce, who's a renowned author, columnist, and consultant who earned degrees from Western Carolina University, the University of Alabama, and the University of Tennessee before becoming a history professor at UNC Asheville. Dan is an avid outdoorsman, passionate about NASCAR, moonshine history, Appalachian culture, environmental issues, and race relations. He lives with his family in Black Mountain, North Carolina. Hello, Dan. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good to be here. It's good to be here. It's a little hot right now, but we're getting over it, right?
Hopefully.
Yeah. So like me, you're a native of Western North Carolina. You grew up in West Asheville, right?
I did. I hesitate to call myself a native because I was born in Arkansas. But as they say, I got here as quickly as I could. I was three when I arrived in West Asheville. I've always said the good Lord, I'm thankful to the good Lord for calling my dad to come pastor the Grace Baptist Church in West Asheville. And so I grew up there. And kind of a, as I put it, a combination of Mayberry and a cotton mill town in West Asheville at that time, which is not at all what West Asheville is today.
No, it's changed a little bit.
It's changed a little lot.
Well, you know, I just relocated with my family back. I grew up in Haywood County, right next to Asheville. My family's been in that county for over 200 years. So, I was born and raised and all that sort of thing. But then I spent 27 years in New York City, where my kids were born. And I just relocated the whole kit and caboodle back to Asheville. So it's a great place to come. And, as you mentioned, it's changed a lot, I think, in a positive way. But I thought it was pretty cool when we were growing up. What was it like growing up in West Asheville?
Well, like I said, it was kind of a combination of Mayberry and a cotton mill town, and of course we were very much free range kids at the time and, rode our bikes all over West Asheville and walked. I remember one particular Saturday, my buddy Steve Harris and I just decided on the spur of the moment, we'd walk to the top of Spivey Mountain, which is out in the Lester area. So we walked out Lester Highway. I mean, we were maybe, 11, 12 years old walked to the top of Spivey Mountain and back. Nobody knew, it was probably, 10, 15 miles that we walked that day, but that was the place I grew up, and you knew everybody and, pretty much. And, it was just one of those kind of neighborhoods. So, the other great thing was being in Western North Carolina, and particularly once you got a little more mobile and wheels, we went to the mountains a lot. And, we go to the top of a mountain and play capture the flag and stuff like that, or roll rocks off the side of the mountain or things like that, and go to swimming holes and all that kind of stuff. So it was a great, I didn't know it at the time, but it was a great, great place to grow up.
It's still good. I went right in our backyard so far. We're in North Asheville, right? And we're on a real, real wonderful street, and our kids bike on the street just like you remember, and they're out there with other kids, and all we have to do is yell car and all the kids get off the road. But it's there's not really that much traffic. But what's interesting is that in the week that we've been here, we've had a black bear and two deer in our backyard, which I don't really remember Asheville being that prevalent for big wildlife.
There were no turkeys there. You never saw a bear unless you're in the Smokies and their head was in a garbage can. And you never saw deer. It's really one of the great changes recently. Well, I'd prefer to see bears a little less frequently in my yard. Actually, one got up. I've got my bird feeder strung about 15 feet up off the ground, and one of them figured out how to get up there and kind of twang the wire and got one of the bird feeders to bounce off today. So a lot, we saw him trying it the other day and I shot him with a BB gun. I don't know if I can say that. Yeah. Is that illegal? But and scared him off, but he got my bird feeder today and I can't find it.
So. No. BB guns and rock salt were the thing back in the day. And I think they're probably still could have their uses. I think it's interesting. You grew up in West Asheville. It's changed a lot, like you mentioned. What would you think is the biggest change?
Well, the real estate prices. They were just talking about, is there going to be $1 million bungalow for sale in West Asheville soon? It's just crazy. The homes, it was very blue collar when I grew up there. And of course you had the Asheville Speedway down there having races and, as some people put it, went to the fights and a race broke out,
Yeah, right.
It was a pretty rough place, but, and the only dining establishment really was the Tasty Diner, where you could go sit at the bar with Jack Ingram, he's in the NASCAR Hall of Fame. So
it's a great foodie place now, man. There's some great restaurants out there. Yeah. I love Jargon, right? Yeah.
Well, those weren't there. It's kind of one of those deals, I hear they're good. I don't get to West Asheville much anymore.
Well, Jargon is good. There's a really great coffee place. I'm drawing a blank on the name right now, the Early Girl has opened up at West Asheville, which is a really good, farm to table thing. So, it's become a great place to go and pick up some really good food. I'm telling you right now, everybody should go visit there. And then they got the artsy sort of scene going on and performance and things like that. And I read the interview.
Best part of my day was the chili dog at the Surfside.
Yeah, right. or I remember driving back, and we'd always stop at West Asheville at the Denny's after being at the nightclub, but that don't seem to be open anymore. So I read an interview that you said something to the effect that folks around Asheville had no pretense, or they are who they are, take it or leave it. Do you feel that's the way they are now too?
It's hard to say,
Yeah, right.
It's a different, I don't have as good a read on, the recent arrivals as I did on the, folks I grew up with, but.
Well, it's very true. When I grew up, the same thing. And I think that the people that are local here are, and I think it rubs off. I do think that people come from different areas, lose a little bit of the pretense and they become a little bit more authentic. I mean, not as authentic as, what we grew up with, but, there was somebody, I read somewhere that, nobody really has a fancy car in Asheville. Everybody has, practical cars, right?
Well, mine is a truck with a We Still Possum Hunt bumper sticker on it. So
I'm driving my dad's 1984 GMC truck. This current gas plan, and I'm not driving it that much. Hey, listen, we have to take a break and we'll come back. I'll talk a little bit more about your history and then get into some of your books. All right.
Are you a business owner? Do you want to be a business owner? Do you work with business owners? Hi, I'm Stephen Fry, your small and medium-sized business or SMB guy, and I'm the host of the new show, Always Friday. While I love to have fun on my show, we take those Friday feelings of freedom and clarity to discuss popular topics on the minds of SMBs today. Please join me and my various special guests on Friday at 11 a.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
Our Are you on edge? Hey, we live in challenging, edgy times, so let's lean in. I'm Sandra Bargeman, the host of The Edge of Every Day, which airs each Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc. Tune in live with me and my friends and colleagues as we share stories and perspectives about pushing boundaries and exploring our rough edges. That's The Edge of Every Day on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
This is Joseph Franklin McElroy back with the Gateway to the Smokies podcast and my guest, Dan Beers. So, Dan, you grew up in Asheville, then you left it to go get your Bachelor of Science at Western Carolina University, and your Master's at Alabama, and then your PhD at the University of Tennessee. And now, lo and behold, you're a renowned writer and history professor. Did you always want to be a teacher and writer?
A teacher, I think, was something I arrived at, in my late teens. I worked at I had a parks program in Asheville, and I ran a park for a couple of summers. I liked kids a lot. So I ended up majoring in education. I taught fifth grade for 3 years and I had kind of a weird experience educationally. I was a horrible student. I was kind of an obnoxious kid, but I had a sixth grade teacher that was really inspiring. She loved history. And then a weird thing happened where she was a widow. She asked me if I'd like to go to Europe. And so she ended up taking me the next summer after my seventh grade year to Europe, me and another 12-year-old boy. It was a lot.
Wow, that's a stunning thing. Oh my God. It changed your life. Wow.
Yeah, it was really strange. And then she ended up being my mom's best friend. So,
wow.
And just a dear, her name was Jean Bennett, and just a wonderful person. So she kind of inspired me to teach. And then I had a lot of bad examples, I think, that I learned from too along the way, you know, about what not to do. And so I taught fifth grade, loved that. But was young, single, pulled up and went to Alabama, which was a great experience for 2 years, and got my master's and kind of cast my lot with Southern history at that point. Then I got married and moved to Nashville, Tennessee, and taught high school for 8 years. And I was Coach Pierce for that time, and really enjoyed that stage of my life. But then decided with the help of my wife to go back for a PhD. So I finished my PhD at about the age of 40. And so, you know, I kind of came to this late in life. And then, the first book, I guess I was 45 when the first book came out. So I really never imagined, you know, I've always been an avid reader, but I never imagined being a writer. And then, I just had some great mentors in graduate school that simplified things for me. Writing was always painful for me, and then they simplified things, made it much easier, and taught me how to sit down and write, you know. And so then that, you know, that, I don't know, you know, seven books.
Would you start writing before you came to UNC Asheville?
Well, I had to write a dissertation. Well, I had to do a master's thesis and a dissertation. And so that.
But didn't write any books until you got to UNCA.
Yeah. Well, the dissertation became the first book, but I had to do some significant rewriting on it. And I've been very fortunate to be the places where I've been, where I've kind of been able to pick and choose what I wanted to do research on and write about. So, you know, I have a good time with it. So, there are some people I know who hated their dissertation topic, and they you know, they hate their research, but they're kind of stuck because of the requirements of their tenure or whatever. And I've just been able to do what I want. So I have a good time and I get to do research by, you know, going hiking in the mountains or going to a stock car race or hanging out with moonshiners.
That's not bad research, right?
Stuff like that, or traveling in the West recently, you know.
How did you get, I mean, I don't know if it's luck or whatever, that to actually get to come back to your hometown and be a professor for so long.
It was totally accidental. I was in graduate school finishing up, and a one-year position opened up at Mars Hill University. And I did that for a year. And then I was fortunate enough to get a one-year deal at UNC Asheville. And then I was fortunate enough to get a one-year deal at Western Carolina University. And then I kind of adjuncted for a while. And finally, I think UNC Asheville figured I wasn't going to go away, and they finally hired me on tenure track.
That's fabulous.
So, yeah. And
well, UNC Asheville is a very interesting place. You know, we where we moved, I'm right there, right? So I'm paying attention. You know, I actually, you know, I've been an artist. I've been in some museums and things. But, you know, one of my first, actually my first formal training in art was at UNC Asheville. I mean, I'd gone to Duke, and then I'd had a career in technology, but then I burned out for a little while and just sort of tooled around. And my first formal training of any sort at school was at UNC Asheville before I moved on up north and went to other places. But so it's sort of fun for me to be living there, you know. It's and it's a great place. They're having something very soon that I think is interesting. You're having a world-class conference called the Idea Festival.
Yeah,
that's pretty crazy, right?
Yeah, they got you know, lots of well-known speakers, John Meacham.
They got some major people. I'm in the middle of moving. Yeah, you know, I'm still doing this. I can't go, but I'll probably go next year. It looks great.
Yeah.
So your books and articles cover a pretty wide range of subjects. All of them interesting. You already started mentioning them. But in 2010, you released Real NASCAR, White Lightning, Red Clay, and Big Bill France. Was that your first book?
No, that was the second. The first one was 10 years before that. Actually, it was my dissertation. It was on it's called The Great Smokies, From Natural Habitat to National Park. And it's on establishment of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. So it kind of casts, that's kind of been, I guess if I have an area, you know, four of my books are related to the Great Smoky Mountains. So,
it looks like you have a series on NASCAR too, and moonshining. So you have,
and
you got some interest.
There's some overlap there. So I did the NASCAR book, and then a guy with the Great Smoky Mountains Association, an editor there, asked me to do a book on moonshine in the Smokies. And then that turned into a bigger book on moonshine in North Carolina. So, they all kind of run together in kind of a weird way.
Well, why did you write a book on NASCAR? What was your interest there?
Well, the big thing, I'd always, you know, I grew up, as I put it, within earshot of what they call the New Asheville Speedway or the river, which was kind of a legend.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, down on Amboy Road in West Asheville, and it was a big hangout. I was kind of, well, evilly influenced by my brother, my older brother, and he was all about kind of living down your West Asheville roots and your redneck roots and hanging out with the North Asheville kids and all that. So I never went to a race there. I never thought about it. We just didn't do that kind of thing, you know, Baptist preacher's son. And so I always kind of made fun of it. But then I had a roommate at Western Carolina, who was avid. I mean, he still is. And he kept trying to get me to go to races. And then finally, right as I was finishing up my PhD work at Tennessee, he was living in East Tennessee. He said, I got tickets. I got a couple of tickets to Bristol. Why don't you come go with me? And so I thought, well, you can't call yourself a Southern historian if you've never been to Bristol, you know? And so, that was 1994. And I went to my first race, was the night race at Bristol. I didn't have a clue about anything. First thing, he didn't say anything about how loud it was, and I didn't have any earplugs or anything. I thought I was going to go deaf. And so fortunately I had a strap on my sunglasses, and I was able to stuff that in my ears And but the thing that got me, I think, I mean, the racing was incredible. I mean, it was just really exciting. But the thing that got me were the fans that just were unreal. I mean, just the passion.
Fanatics about it.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. There was a guy.
What explains that popularity? Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I don't see it as intense as it was at that time. But it was intense. And I'll never forget, there was a guy sitting in front of us, and we were way up near the top. And I don't know, we were 100 rows up or more. And this guy was sitting there. He had a big old cooler he brought in. I don't know how many beers he drank, but but he would, they at Bristol's a half mile track, so they're coming by every 15, 16 seconds. This guy would stand up every time Dale Earnhardt's car came by and shoot him a bird.
So you think it was a little bit like pro wrestling?
I don't know. Well, it was,
drivers had a little bit of a character that that represented something. Yeah,
but I mean, there was a lot of that kind of. It was very almost a moral drama, almost, particularly at that time. Jeff Gordon was coming on the scene as kind of the clean cut California kid, you know, and here's Dale Earnhardt, this gruff, you know, rough and tumble guy who worked in a cotton mill, you know, and you know, grease under his fingernails kind of guy, which is not necessarily true, but he had that image, you know? And so it was great. You know, I mean, it was just intense, you know?
Now the first big name in NASCAR was William Henry Getty, Big Bill France. Well, what was his position in the sports?
Well, he was the founder, basically. The owner, I mean, the France family, it's unique in professional sports in that NASCAR is owned by the France family, still is. Wow. It's run by the France family. And so his brother or his son, Jim France, is pretty much the head of it now. But then his grandchildren, well, Brian France is kind of out of the picture now. He ran it for a while, a grandchild, but Lisa France Kennedy is has a big hand in it, so it's still a family run business. He kind of ran it with an iron fist back in the day. Of course, it was
in those days. All those guys were like,
yeah. I mean, it was a pretty rough crowd, you know. Yeah. And, you know, there were a lot of those guys, you know, got their first high speed driving experience behind of a, you know, a 39 Ford coupe, you know, hauling liquor.
Yeah,
you know, road somewhere. So
I'm trying to get the front end of one of those coupes to put in. We got the moonshine room. I was going to put it in there. Yeah. So, you know, we'll take a break soon, but you declare at the end of that book, I would humbly suggest that it's time for NASCAR to stop modernizing tradition and start embracing its tradition. What's the simple explanation of that statement?
Well, they kind of hidden from their moonshine roots. They're doing a little bit more now, but I think they ought to embrace it. You know, I think that they, it's a great story, you know, about these guys who had nothing, you know, but were very creative and entrepreneurial and aggressive, you know.
Maybe. Hey, listen, some of my relatives ran moonshine, and they had souped up cars, man, and the stories of them racing through the hills to avoid revenuers are pretty hair-raising, right? So cool. Well, we got to take another break. When I come back, I want to talk a little bit more about moonshining and your books on that.
Howdy, I am Joseph Franklin McElroy, host of the new podcast, Gateway to the Smokies. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Tuesday night from 6 p.m. to 7. Every episode is dedicated to memorable experiences in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and surrounding areas. This show features experts and locals who will expound upon the richness of culture, history, and adventure that awaits you in the Smokies. Tune in every Tuesday from 6 p.m. to 7 on talkradio.nyc.
Are you passionate about the conversation around racism? Hi, I'm Reverend Dr. TLC, host of the Dismantle Racism Show, which airs every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc. Join me and my amazing guests as we discuss ways to uncover, dismantle, and eradicate racism. That's Thursdays at 11 o'clock a.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a small business trying to navigate the COVID-19 related employment laws? Hello, I'm Eric Sauver, employment law business law attorney and host of the new radio show, Employment Law Today. On my show, we'll have guests to discuss the common employment law challenges business owners are facing during these trying times. Tune in on Tuesday evenings from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Howdy, this is Joseph Franklin McElroy, the Gateway to the Smokies podcast with my guest, Dan Pierce. So Dan, you know, you wrote another book. You've actually written a couple books about moonshining, and you wrote another one that combined NASCAR and moonshining called Tar Heel Lightning, How Secret Stills and Fast Cars Made North Carolina the Moonshine Capital of the World. So we talked about how moonshine helped NASCAR. How did NASCAR and fast cars make North Carolina the moonshine capital?
Well, it's a long story, but from the very beginning, when making whiskey became illegal, that is, if you didn't pay the federal excise tax, and that was went into effect in North Carolina right after the Civil War. North Carolina, from the very beginning, you know, there was a long tradition of making whiskey in North Carolina. I mean, going back to the earliest white settlers who brought that skill with them. And brought their stills with them, perfectly legal activity, with few exceptions up until then. And, you know, they weren't about to give it up, you know, and so it was too important of an economic activity. They couldn't make any money if they on it, if they paid the tax. And so they made it illegally. And so it just became very much ingrained in North Carolina history and culture, as hard as the federal government. And then when around the turn of the century, you started getting prohibition, and then North Carolina became one of the first states to have statewide prohibition in 1909. And it's kind of interesting. There's that dynamic with prohibition and moonshine, that they really go hand in hand. And part of the reason North Carolina was moonshine was so important in North Carolina and so big in North Carolina was because prohibition was so strong. And so, you know, even after national, you know, you had national prohibition, when that ended, you still had local option in North Carolina. And so most counties were dry well into the 60s and 70s, and even still have some dry municipalities and stuff like that around the state. But again, it was a long time before, you know, most people could buy legal liquor in this state. So there was a great market for moonshine, which of course fed into NASCAR, you know, as kind of a two-way street there. You know, you had people who became successful drivers who figured out they could make more money hauling liquor than they could winning races. So, you know.
Well, it was an important economic it was an economic boon for people in the mountains, even though it was also devastating, you know, and a lot of social ills from it as well. But you know, it was like quick money, right? Yeah, there was, you couldn't get loans, you couldn't get anything else, but you could make right. quick money with moonshine, right?
Yeah, for a lot of people, it was kind of an insurance policy. And, you know, most people were not career moonshiners, you know, they weren't your popcorn Suttons, you know, who did it all their life. You know, they did it, you know, when they were... there was kind of an economic emergency, or they're young, they're, you know, they're kind of, you know, starting out. So a lot of people, you know, it's kind of funny, you know, you talk to people and everybody says, oh, well, you know, in my family, you know, so-and-so hauled liquor or something like that. And it was just a common thing, you know, for a lot of people, it was one of the few ways that you could get cash money.
Yeah. Yeah, it was hard to get cash, right?
So. Big cash money. And, you know, if you're willing to take the risk. And so, you know, for a lot of people, it was, you know, almost an expect, depending on the community you're in, you know, it was almost an expected thing, you know, and for a lot of people, it wasn't a great, you know, particularly in rural areas, it wasn't a great disability. You know, the preacher might preach against it, but the preacher understood too, that, you needed to do what you could to put shoes on your kids' feet and feed them. And so, and the preacher also knew that he got, you know, that money in the offering plate often came from liquor money. So,
and listen, all the general stores loved it because where'd they buy the sugar? Where'd they buy the, you know, the components? It fed the economy in general. So, you know, it was, and then, you know, they got in things different. You wrote a book called Corn from a Jar, which we actually carry here at the Metal Ark, that explored a lot of these issues, didn't it?
Yeah, it looks specifically at the Smokies, but again, you know, that's a
excuse me. And they say moonshine's good for a cough.
Well, it is. I got a freezer full of it. People keep giving it to me.
You know? Oh yeah.
Well, they're still a pretty active.
Oh man, I get people showing up at the motel, and we have our pavilion. We have a bluegrass festival or something. Man, everybody's giving me moonshine.
Yeah. And so, yeah. Oh, I got a freezer full of it.
Right? Yeah,
I do need to go get a sip of it. But
my dad, you know, he has a bunch of it. He probably still has. He used to meet with popcorn. He probably still has some of popcorn.
Well, I think everybody has some purportedly.
Yeah,
popcorn moonshine. I've heard a lot of it. Oh yeah, I got some popcorn moonshine.
So what's that? You know, there was a lot of cultural representations of moonshiners, and I think a lot of that, you know, was purposely, you know, denigrating people, making them into bumpkins. But what do you think is the side of moonshine that most people have never seen?
Well, there are a lot of signs. And that was what the book Tar Heel Lightning is really about. It's kind of complicating, I guess, the image, you know, because people's image of moonshiner is kind of Popcorn Sutton, you know. The guy with the beard and the overalls and the old truck and, you know, and the foul mouth and, you know, and apparently Popcorn was no dummy for sure. And, you know, one, they were, a lot of these people were very smart. They were very entrepreneurial. They were very skilled. I've often talked about Junior Johnson, who's a famous stock car driver and car owner, but he, of course, got his start, you know, in the family business, which was moonshine. But I've often said about Junior Johnson, I think he's one of the smartest people. He didn't come across as particularly intelligent, but he was one of the smartest people I've ever encountered. And I've often said he probably never read a physics book, but I think he could write one. And so a lot of these people were really smart. The other thing was that, we have this image of the white mountaineer, and the fact of the matter is, in North Carolina in particular, and in most of the South, it was all over. I mean, you know, there was many coastal swamp moonshiners as there were mountain moonshiners, you know, and so, or in the Piedmont, it was all over. And it was, and they weren't white. They weren't all white. There were a lot of Native American, particularly among the Lumbee, down the eastern part of North Carolina.
Well, they sort of taught moonshiners about corn
the first moonshiners in North Carolina were African American and Native American, because in the 1830s the legislature passed a law that said free persons of color could not make liquor or sell liquor. Uh-huh. And so they were making it illegally before white people were.
Yeah, and they were using.
There was a long tradition. Plus, there was also traditions of slave plantation distilleries using slave labor. So they, you know, a lot of African Americans knew how to make liquor.
Oh, they knew how to make it good too.
Yeah. And then the other thing I think that kind of blows people's mind was the number of women involved. That's just a fascinating story, you know,
especially on the brandy they made from those, that moonshine, right? They would add apple and things like that. Yeah.
Well, if you had fruit trees, you know, back in the, well before refrigeration became common, if you had fruit trees, there was one reason why you did, and that was to make brandy or Applejack or something like that, some sort of alcohol from it. Because you couldn't, you know, if you had a big orchard, I mean, you couldn't preserve all that and you couldn't get it to market, but you could distill it and you could get that to market and it would really sell too.
Well, find the things that you can, you know, I just discovered I could make mead from honey here at the motel. And once we get our fortified wine and liquor license, and I'm going to be making our own mead. Hey, it's a tradition to figure out what you could do.
There you go. That's right. Yeah. Whatever you have at hand, you know.
But, you know, I want to get to, you know, you said you wrote four books about the Great Smoky Mountains and I think the first one was Natural Habitat to National Parks. So it seems you're a passionate environmentalist. Can you tell us about this book?
Yeah. Well, again, it's on the establishment of the park, and it's a great story. It's a unique story because Smokies and Shenandoah were created in a unique way. At that time, in the 1920s, Congress said they would not purchase lands for national parks. All the national parks were in the West, and they were in the federal domain, and all you did was change the sign, basically, of which federal agency is managing it. So, but the Congress wouldn't buy land for national parks. And so, but then they said, if the states will buy the land, and we approve this land as appropriate for a national park, then the states can turn the land over to us and we'll make it a national park. And so that's what happened, but it was a long, slow process because they had to raise the money to buy the land. So they had private donations, they had state bonds. And then finally it was John D. Rockefeller Jr. who donated $5 million to make it happen. So it's a unique thing. So people of Western North Carolina and East Tennessee feel a real sense of ownership. About the park that other places don't have.
Cool. Well, you know, I think we could take a break right now and you can get some more water and then we'll come back. We'll talk more about some of your books and some of the other things that you've done. And
I'll add a little moonshine to it. So.
Hey everybody, it's Tommy D, the Nonprofit Sector Connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host a program, Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on talkradio.nyc.
In a post-COVID world, you may have many unanswered questions regarding your health. Are you looking to live a healthier lifestyle? Do you have a desire to learn more about mental health and enhance your quality of life? Or do you just want to participate in self-understanding and awareness? I'm Frank R. Harrison, host of Frank About Health, and each Thursday, I will tackle these questions and work to enlighten you. Tune in every Thursday at 5 p.m. on talkradio.nyc, and I will be Frank About Health to advocate for all of us.
All pet lovers,
pet Avengers, assemble!
On the Professionals and Animal Lovers show, we believe the bond between animal lovers is incredibly strong. It mirrors that bond between pets and their owners. Through this program, we come together to learn, educate, and advocate.
Join us live every Wednesday at 2 p.m. at talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Hey, this is Joseph Franklin McElroy back with the Gateway to the Smokies podcast and my guest, Dan Pierce. So Dan, you wrote several books about the Great Smokies National Park. I mentioned the one that was really popular, From Natural Habitat to National Parking. What are some of the others that people might look up
I did the one on Moonshine of the Smokies, Corn from a Jar. It's probably the book that sold the most. And then I did a book on community of Hazel Creek in Swain County, which was displaced. And then there was a long, long controversy about the road to nowhere there in that county that was resolved, you know, maybe 10 years ago, finally after 50 years or so. And that's just a real interesting community and kind of a legendary community. It's kind of, now it's more kind of a legend as a trout fishing destination, but
it's got good trout fishing. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. But, and then the most recent one I did, if you can kind of see in the background there, I'll lean my head over, is a poster by an artist, a graphic artist by the name of Joel Anderson. Joel and I were friends when I lived in Nashville 30 years ago, and then we lost touch with one another, and he went on to a very successful career, started his own company, and then he gave up basically his advertising business to just do poster art full time, and he has an incredible business. His best-selling posters are national park posters, and so he did a book in 2016 for the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service on all the national parks, and used his poster art, and his son did the text. And so I brought him to UNCA to do a program about art in the national parks. And over dinner, he asked me if I would be interested in doing a book with him and on the Smokies. And so I said, sure. And so we made about seven or eight trips into the Smokies, had some great adventures, saw some really cool places. It was so much fun to take him and his son around to see a lot of these places that had meant so much to me, and I learned a lot in the process. But anyway, that turned into a book called The Illustrated Guide to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and which is sold in all the park bookstores now, and it's just a great kind of coffee table book. So it was a real departure.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
And so that was so much fun, and we had so much fun doing the trips together and all that, you know. And again, you know, doing quote research, you know, and going to the park. And so then that morphed into one that just came out, which is an illustrated guide to the Grand Circle of Arizona and Utah. And so it's Southern Utah and Northern.
Oh, you found a niche that's selling, huh? That's
So that was just out, but that was so much fun. We had
You've done some fun books. I saw that you co-wrote a book debating the merits of NASCAR versus college football in the South. So how did that come about? What was the conclusion?
Well, I won, but it was actually a debate, that was done on the South Carolina Public Radio, which was broadcast all over, I think, on a lot. It was a series called Tell About the South, and it was, they brought on two scholars to discuss or debate some issue. So, a guy named Hardy Jackson, who was from Jacksonville State, in Alabama, did the football side, and I did the NASCAR side. And so I think I whipped him, but
you whipped him. All right, cool. And then you one of your books, and I didn't find out which one, you tell me, won the Western North Carolina Historical Association Outstanding Achievement Award. Which one was the book?
Well, that was just achievement award was just kind of a lifetime achievement
thing. Oh, it was a lifetime achievement.
It was a specific book. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's nice. I mean, you've got some great titles. I think it's really great. But I also think that you are very passionate about equal rights and racial diversity. Our associate Bob Plott, and his a mutual friend wrote about a great book about his son and about the story of WNCR, the railroad and the Murphy Branch, a railroad built almost entirely by convict labor between 1871 and 1891. And it was a brutally inhumane form of legalized slavery supported by both political parties for two decades. Yet few people are aware of this, and the sacrifice made people to open up Western North Carolina to the outside world. You are leading a committee dedicated to honor these inmates, the Railroad Incarcerated Committee. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I live at Ridgecrest, which is one of the most storied sections of the railroad and the big roadblock to building the railroad into Western North Carolina was what was called the Swannanoa Grade or the Mountain Division of the railroad. So it was so hard to, so this is about a 3 mile stretch as the crow flies, but it's 9 miles of railroad. So it twists and turns up the mountain. There's seven tunnels in that section. It took 3 years using over 3,000 incarcerated laborers in the North Carolina State Penitentiary.
Basically slavery.
Yes, and it was brutal. And again, they're using nitroglycerin. It's very dangerous work. They're cramped together in horrible conditions. And we know from the records that at least 139 of these people died in the process, and countless other injuries, and you know, probably permanent injuries as well. We just don't know.
Wow.
But there've been a few books written and some, you know, there's a little awareness, but there's no public recognition. There's a group of us, it actually kind of started on my front porch over breakfast with a friend of mine who's named Steve Little, and he's a lawyer and the mayor of Marion, North Carolina, but a big railroad buff. And he's been fascinated by this section of railroad since he was a kid. And so we contacted some folks and put together a committee of people from McDowell County and Buncombe County, build a memorial. And so it's kind of like the Little Rascals, you know, we didn't really know what we were doing, you know, it's kind of like, let's put on a show, but we didn't have a clue as to what we're doing. And so we just kind of, you know, one of our committee members put together a website, and we just started contacting people and got some good publicity, and the Western North Carolina Historical Association partnered with us, and we're able to put a donate now button on the thing. And, money started coming in, and before we knew it, we said, okay, now we got the money.
You know, a lot of people here remember the railroads back in the day. My great grandfather was an engineer for the logging railroads. And that was a brutal, brutal, brutal business.
Yeah.
You know, and prison labor got the worst of it. So I think it's a good thing that you're doing. Yeah. And I appreciate it. You know, we're getting close to the end here. I want you to have the opportunity to shout out anything we haven't mentioned, or where people can look up your books or get in contact with you, or however you want them to remember from this podcast.
Well, yeah, always looking for folks. Check out, I would encourage folks to check out Anderson Design Group, which has the coffee table books, and it's just an incredible site with all, you know, if you love the Smokies and you want to have something on your wall, his posters are just incredible. And so I would encourage you to do that, to patronize the park gift shops that Akon Lefty and in Bryson City and all over the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. I'm on their board. And so all right. The seeds, come back to the park in a great way, and they sell my book. So
are you on Facebook or anything?
What?
Are you on Facebook? Do you have a page?
No, you know, I, I'm not. I haven't done social media.
You're a Luddite. Okay.
Well, I've done it in the past, but it just kind of eats up your life in some ways. And so I don't. But I would also encourage folks to check out Rail, RAIL.org, which is our website for the Rail project. One of the really cool things, just real quickly, we've done recently is to bring in human remains detection dogs and ground penetrating radar, and have located some mass graves, which is sad and tragic, but we're going to be able to, we are looking for funds to be able to mark those places and do what we can. We can't bring those people back, but it's important work, I think. So
thank you so much for being on the show. I enjoy the books that you've written, and I've read a little bit of The Corn in the Jar, and I've read some others of yours, and I look forward to seeing what you do in the future, and we should keep in touch. So thank you for being on the show.
Enjoy it thoroughly. Thank you.
This is the Gateway to the Smokies podcast. You can find out more about us at facebook.com/Gateway to the Smokies podcast, as well as on the talkradio.nyc network, where they have lots of live podcasts that are worthwhile going to look at and watch, ranging from small business to self-help to travel, like we're having here. I also have another podcast called Wise Content Creates Wealth, which is about marketing and AI. Helping businesses, achieve better results with their content marketing. And that's on Fridays from noon till 1. And don't forget to check out the Metalark Motel. Call 828-926-1717 for a reservation for any of the events, or just come and visit us. I'd love to see you. So see you next week for this podcast, Gateway of the Smokies, from 6 until 7 on Tuesday night. And until then, have a good week.
Uplift, educate, empower.
Are you a business owner? Do you want to be a business owner? Do you work with business owners? Hi, I'm Stephen Fry, your small and medium-sized business or SMB guy, and I'm the host of the new show, Always Friday. While I love to have fun on my show, we take those Friday feelings of freedom and clarity to discuss popular topics on the minds of SMBs today. Please join me and my various special guests on Friday at 11 a.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Are you on edge? Hey, we live in challenging, edgy times, so let's lean in. I'm Sandra Bargeman, the host of The Edge of Every Day, which airs each Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc. Tune in live with me and my friends and colleagues as we share stories and perspectives about pushing boundaries and exploring our rough edges. That's The Edge of Every Day on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
Calling all pet lovers.
Pet Avengers, assemble!
On the Professionals and Animal Lovers show, we believe the bond between animal lovers is incredibly strong. It mirrors that bond between pets and their owners. Through this program, we come together to learn, educate, and advocate.
Join us live every Wednesday at 2 p.m. at talkradio.nyc.
In a post-COVID world, you may have many unanswered questions regarding your health. Are you looking to live a healthier lifestyle? Do you have a desire to learn more about mental health and enhance your quality of life? Or do you just want to participate in self-understanding and awareness? I'm Frank R. Harrison, host of Frank About Health, and each Thursday, I will tackle these questions and work to enlighten you. Tune in every Thursday at 5 p.m. on talkradio.nyc, and I will be Frank About Health to advocate for all of us.
McElroy, host
host of the new podcast, Gateway to the Smokies. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Tuesday night from 6 p.m. to 7. Every episode is dedicated to memorable experiences in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and surrounding areas. This show features experts and locals who will expound upon the richness of culture, history, and adventure that awaits you in the Smokies. Tune in every Tuesday from 6 p.m. to 7 on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.